Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. Today we have Philip Goldberg with us, and some of you remember Phil from his last book called American Veda, which is a phenomenal book. If you have not read it, you should run and get it. It's been out for many years now. His new book called Karmic Relief, and that's what we're going to be talking about today, is karma. What does it mean? And we're looking at it from all different angles, from what the Stoics or the Christians or the Buddhists or the Hindus, you know, what do people really think karma is? How does it work? And in the end, you know, I read the book ahead of time before this interview. I was just dying to get to the bottom line. What is it? What do we need to do? How can we get there? How can we work on our karma? Whether you really believe there's a past life or not, I really wanted to know, like, what's the bottom line? I see all these different ways people are thinking about it, agreeing with it, disagreeing with it. Fine. But what can I do to help myself have better karma and to feel better more of the time? And I think Phil did a great job in this interview answering just that question. So I hope you enjoy it, and we'll see you on the other side. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. This is Amy Wheeler. We're in the second half of 2025, and we've spent this entire year telling stories of health, healing, and beyond with yoga therapy, yoga, and Ayurveda. I hope you'll join us for the second half of the year, where we hear people who are courageous and generous and authentic and kind, telling about their life experience so that they can help others out there who might be going through something similar. Let's get into season 9 and hear more stories about people just like you. All right, on to the show. Welcome, Phil. Nice to have you back on the Yoga Therapy Hour.
Good to be with you again, Amy.
Phil, just for those of you who maybe didn't listen to the first episode with you, which I'll try to highlight in the show notes, where are you joining us from?
I'm in Western Massachusetts, but I can't remember if I had already moved here the first time.
You did, because you have the same bookshelf and you have American Veda over your right shoulder with the beautiful yellow cover, one of your most popular books. And now over your left shoulder, I see your new book called Karmic Relief, which is what we're going to be talking about today.
The new edition, strategically placed above my shoulder.
Yeah. Well, I remember the American Veda from last time we talked. So I think you were moved to Western Mass already.
Okay.
Well, I want to dive right in because I want to use this entire time together to squeeze out all the juicy details of this amazing book.
Well, we'll have to leave some for people to want to buy it.
Of course, of course. Okay. No, I did keep that in mind. I left a lot of gems untouched.
Right.
But first of all, I just want to say that I think you had said somewhere that it was your wife who kept kind of nudging you.
Yeah.
Like, hey, Phil, you got to write that book on karma. Tell us a little bit about that.
The backstory is I've been interested in karma ever since I first got interested in yoga philosophy and Vedanta and all the whole package of Eastern philosophy, which drew me like a magnet when I was a young man and changed my life. And I pondered karma and became part of my worldview at a certain point. And then I saw it become used more and more frequently in public life and commercials and song titles and newscasts, even sports reports and everyday speech. And so every once in a while, I think I should write a book on this. And at one point, I used the phrase karmic relief in a sentence, and I thought, oh, that's a good title. And I stored it away and worked on other things and was never sure I should tackle the subject. But every once in a while, my wife would say, you should get back, think about that book on karma. So would my agent, who has since passed. And then I got a new agent after my other one died, and she said she liked the idea. So, after a while, you stop resisting.
Oh, first, I'm sorry to hear that your agent had passed away. That is a deep relationship.
It was, and she was a close friend as well.
Yeah, that's hard. All right, so let's just start off with how you laid it out in the beginning before you go into the depths of the ocean of karma. You basically said there's kind of two ways that we, on a surface level, before we go into that deeper level, that we think of this, that one is kind of a cynicism of materialism, where like nothing's going to come. If you do bad things, there will be no justice.
The universe is not a fair place. Get over it.
Yeah. And then the second one is that there's this all-powerful being that's kind of watching what we do. And inevitably, we can just trust that they will take care of it and reconciliation will happen.
Well, yes, that was the prevailing religious perspective in the Western traditions, that is the only way to explain why good people suffer and bad people seem to prosper, is to say, well, it must be God's will, and we can't argue with that. And in the end, the afterlife and so forth, it will all be worked out. But over time, fewer and fewer people are able to make that kind of leap of faith and think of the universe being run by a deity with a personality that judges every person and every deed. And so that belief in that diminished over time. And in a sense, for people like me and to a lesser degree, earlier generations, being exposed to the Eastern teachings and karma was a solution, or at least a plausible solution to that eternal question. Somewhere, it wasn't cynicism. It was an assertion that the universe is fair and just, but it doesn't require a personality deity that intervenes. It's more like a law of nature. It's more like physics than belief system or theology. And so that's one of the reasons I think karma has caught on, even though it's often misunderstood. People use it as a shorthand for everything we do has consequences.
Well, you just gave an overview of all the interesting ideas that I picked out of the book and took notes on. Can we start way back at the beginning before we unfold this beautiful package together? You had written that Christians like St. Augustine attempted to kind of reconcile this, saying that the sinner's understanding that they sinned is sufficient punishment. And of course, now all the rage is like narcissism. Everybody's a narcissist. So honoring St. Augustine, there is something to be said that a lot of the times we don't even realize we've done anything wrong. We don't think we've done anything wrong, narcissist or not. We are standing in our shoes from our perspective, and we're oftentimes pointing the finger, thinking they did something wrong. Well, I didn't do anything wrong, right?
And, I really appreciated learning about St. Augustine and others. That was their way of reconciling, why the evildoers and people who behave badly seem to prosper and not get what's coming to them. They said, well, they have to live with this, and that is, punishment in a sense. That's hard to live with. Emerson alluded to that as well, Ralph Waldo Emerson. And that's a comforting thought. And we all have that experience that there's some truth to that. We lie to somebody, we cheat about even small thing, and we feel some guilt or shame. But you have to have a conscience for that to be true.
Right. And be self-reflective.
And be reflective enough. And the evidence points to the fact that there's a whole lot of people doing very bad things in the world that do not have the capacity for guilt or shame or self-recrimination. We call them psychopaths and sociopaths or just all-out narcissists. And it doesn't hold up as a universal. It's not enough. At least it wasn't for me. But it's a good attempt. And it does work to some degree. Then there's another factor too. Some people will be plagued by guilt and remorse. And that's a form of punishment, so to speak, or a negative consequence of doing something wrong. Some people will be tormented by the fear of getting caught. They don't necessarily have the conscience, but the fear of getting caught and the paranoia and the looking over your shoulder, that's real too. And that can eat away at people. But I don't know if that holds up entirely. And all of those things would be consistent with karma. Those are forms of consequences of our actions. It doesn't always mean everything you do will come back in exactly the same way that you did it. That's oversimplifying things.
And I think you say that in the book, that for those who are maybe self-reflective, filled with guilt or shame, or even worried about getting caught, like those very subtle thoughts, even if they stay inside of us and nobody else knows about them, they shift who we are. They shift our perception of self, and therefore we act differently and our life takes on a different trajectory.
That's right. This gets very interesting and intricate because some people will feel guilt or remorse and be plagued by it and behave better as a result of that. It's like learning a lesson. Okay, I won't do that again. That's learning, and that's personal growth, and that's one way karma keeps us evolving in the world. Other people will say, hey, I didn't get caught, I'll do it again. And, you know, if karma is real, some way, somehow, someday, that will come back to them.
Yeah. And I also want to acknowledge there are people who are trying to survive. And in fact, it may seem strange, but in their attempt to survive, they actually hurt other people. And that's a whole different thing, right?
Or do something that we consider wrong behavior. I go into this in Karmic Relief that it's not just the action itself that has consequences. The motivation behind the action matters, the intention, the thought process. So stealing is wrong. We all know that. But there's a difference between somebody who, say, commits an act of violence while stealing, and somebody who shoplifts a package of cheese to feed a child who's otherwise maybe not going to eat. Both are stealing, but very different situations. And even our legal system acknowledges that. So karma works on the level of the mind and the heart as well as physical actions.
Beautifully said. And so I think that leads us to your next point that you just had mentioned, that it's almost like a law of physics.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about that? You made it, you know, akin to Newton's third law of thermodynamics. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Yes. And that's, you know, law of nature. What goes up must come down, you know, gravity. And if you think about karma, I think one of the reasons karma appeals to people in the modern world is the way it's presented is not as kind of theological doctrine, but as something lawful, that the universe works in a lawful way. There's causes and effect. And we know this from physics and chemistry and all the other sciences, that they study the cause and effect, and there are lawful principles that govern, you know, how one thing causes another and so forth. So karma's like that, and it's an easy analogy to make. And if it's presented properly, as most of the spiritual teachers from the East have done when they came to the West and spoke English, they presented these things in a way that was compatible with rational thinking and a scientific perspective. So if every action in the physical plane has an equal and opposite reaction, why not also something more subtle like our thoughts and our behaviors, and not just, you know, billiard balls or, you know, airplanes?
So can you speak a little bit to the fact that we may not get to see someone receive their karma back, that it's not so linear?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the mistakes people make. Something happens and they say, well, what was the karmic cause of this? And they'll imagine something they did in the past that's analogous. But things are much more complicated than that. I mean, sometimes it is that, you know, you go slap somebody in the face, there's going to be a reaction pretty quickly. There's going to be some instant karma. And you can say, well, that caused this. You throw a ball, it's going to bounce back. You know, things like that. There are consequences. You lie to somebody, they find out, there's a consequence. But most of our actions are much more complicated than that. They're subtle, and they all have an effect in the world that extends further and further in time and space. And according to the laws of karma, will come back to us. But by then, we'll have done many other things that are thrown into the sort of pool of karma, so to speak. And the people we associate with, and our family members, and the people we speak to, and the people we take action with or to, they'll have their own karma and they'll do things. And after a while, things become very complicated. And then things happen to us. Well, you can't trace everything back to a single cause. It's just a worksheet of good actions, neutral actions, harmful actions. And then every once in a while, the return envelope comes and we have a package at the door. The other thing I want to say in this regard, and we all fall into this trap. We tend to think of karma only when bad things happen.
Right.
Oh, it's karma, my karma. Oh, that poor, oh, look what happened. I wonder what their karma is. Good things are happening all the time as a result of our karma. That too is karma. You meet somebody and have a new friend. That's good karma coming to you. You get an unexpected gift. That's good karma. Things go well in your life. You know, all the good things, that too is karma, but we seldom stop and say, oh, gee, I wonder what caused that.
So I have a really hard question. This is, I want to believe in karma. And I think, on my deeper levels of soul, I do believe. But when I see innocent people being hurt, it feels really horrible to me to say, oh, well, that's probably some karma from another life. Or, and then when I see people who are seemingly hurting them, and they're getting all these benefits, that bothers me too. It looks like everything's going their way, and here they are hurting people.
I agree. And that's why it's a difficult pill to swallow. But it's easier for me, anyway, and for many people to take those observations and those reactions, reactions of sympathy and compassion and sometimes anger, in the context of karma. See, you said, I see people suffering, and I don't want to just say, oh, it's their karma. And that makes perfect sense. And sometimes people do that. Their reaction upsets me because I think, okay, we can say it was their karma. It's the karma of the people of Gaza to be experiencing what they are. It's the karma of the people in that flood zone, you know, who are now without homes, whatever it is. If you just dismiss it at that, with indifference and say, well, it's their karma, then it's your karma, how you react. So if you react with a broken heart and with sympathy, even though you know it's karma, you still are reacting as a compassionate human being, then A, you stand a better chance of doing something helpful, and B, the karma would be very different from being callous or indifferent toward human suffering, especially if you're in a position to help and you say, no, why bother? It's their karma. That would be a misuse of the concept of karma, and it would have its own karmic repercussions on the person involved. So I can be angry at people causing harm to others. It's my karma to react that way. Then I have a choice. Do I do anything about it? Do I at least speak up? Do I at least, whatever I can do? And if I can't do anything, at least in my heart, I'm extending sympathy. And maybe I'll vote for the different person or write a check or whatever we can do, even when we feel helpless. But it would be wrong to just write things off as it's their karma. It can be comforting to think that way. But we can't stop at that. Otherwise, we're cruel.
Yeah. Please take a moment with me to go and listen to something a little different, and then we'll get right back to the guest. Many times as yoga teachers, yoga therapists, or even moms, dads, grandparents, we wonder what's happening with our loved one in between the times we're seeing them, whether your child went off to college or whether you're a yoga therapist who only sees your client once a month. You might wonder, how are they doing? Well, here at The Optimal State, we have developed a mobile app where people can track how they're feeling mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually at different times of day, seasons of the year. And basically, you can see the data. You can see how your 6 to 10 a.m. slot in your day looks and how you usually feel at that time versus your 2 to 6 p.m. How do you feel at that time of the day? And you can see the patterns. You can set a week, a month, a season, and get the aggregate data so you can see what your pattern is. Where do you tend to go out of balance? And the cool thing is you can just take a screenshot of that summary and send it off to your yoga teacher, your yoga therapist, your parent, your child. It's a really great way to check in. And I think especially for maybe kids that don't want to call their parents all the time from school, they could just show their parent the data like, okay, I'm doing all right. Here, look at my data for the last 2 weeks. Screenshot, boom, it's yours. Now you can settle down and stop calling me. It could be that, or it could be that your child is not doing well, but they don't know how to say that to you, or maybe your client. And so your client could take a screenshot of their data from the last week and send it to you as they come into the session so you kind of have an idea of what's going on with them. So there's many ways to use it. And in addition, there are wonderful interventions that help people to come into balance. So I hope you'll consider checking out on the App Store. It's called Optimal State App. You just type that in, Optimal State App, and check it out. It's free for the first few weeks, so you have nothing to lose from trying it out and checking out how to track, how to get your aggregate data, how to send that off, and then hopefully how to get some interventions. All right, now let's go back to our guest. Would it be fair to say that regardless of who has what karma, like if I just remove myself from the thought of anyone else's karma and just focused on my skillful action of handling myself and how I relate to others in the world, that's really all I can do? Or do you feel like it's okay to think that so-and-so is going to get what's coming to them?
I find comfort in thinking everything. If you accept karma, then people who do bad, it will come back to them one way or another, sometime or another. It's very hard to discuss these things without saying maybe in a future life, because, we see too many people die happy who are horrible human beings. And we have to adapt our thinking to that as well. But I get some comfort out of that, but I don't want to just leave it at that and say, well, they'll get what's coming to them. But if I can help in some way, if I can make people more aware of it, we all have our own roles to play in life, our own capacities, our own limitations. I write, I give interviews like this, so I can maybe use my voice and my way with words to make a small little contribution. And not just say, well, he'll get what's coming to him someday in the future life. I'd rather see it myself.
I totally understand that. All right. So you get into some ideas about what you call preventative medicine, like a skillful handling of karmic eruptions, and that sometimes we have to take our medicine. Like, it doesn't taste good. And we just have to drink it down.
Yeah. It's, one of the early concepts or metaphors that had a big impact on me when I heard it many, many years ago in the context of karma. Is you do something, say you do something wrong, you know, small thing, big thing, whatever, you do something that would be unethical or immoral. It's like taking out a loan. You now have a debt in the system of karmic law. What do you do now? You take out a loan. You're aware that that loan's going to come due at some point. In this case of taking out a loan, there's a date that's predictable. With karma, we can't predict, but the principle is the same. If before the loan comes due, you spend all the rest of your money and waste it, or you know, gamble on something and lose, then when the loan is due, you got problems. It's going to hurt. Whereas if you're frugal and you do good things and your bank account grows, then when the loan comes due, you'll just pay it off and it won't sting to the same degree. And very similar in our life, no matter what we did in the past, what we did in the past is going to come back to us one way or another at some time or another. But if what we do now, moving forward, is for the good, is ethical, is moral, is righteous, all those things we know we should do and we don't do the things we know we shouldn't do, then the karmic balance sheet changes. So when the past comes back to us, when we get that delivery on the doorstep, you know, we might have the inner resources, the strength, the relationships to handle it better than we would have if we went on doing bad things. And, you know, the sting won't be quite the same because we will have assets to go with the liabilities, so to speak. So that's one of the things I meant by prevention. Preventing the consequences of wrong action from having the impact they might otherwise have. Then, you know, when it comes down to it, whether you want to ameliorate the effect of wrong action in the past, or you're just thinking ahead, I want to have good karma in the future, I want good things to happen to me and the people I care about, behaving properly in the world and doing the right thing and not doing the wrong thing, that's the simple solution. As you put it, behave with skillful action, make the right choices, do the kind thing, do the generous thing. I mean, you know, if I had to summarize how to deal with karma, I would just say what my grandmother used to tell me, be nice. You know,
I mean, it's, that's
in
it,
that
right?
Way, it's simple. Now life gets complicated and it's not always clear what the nice thing to do is and how to balance self-interest with generosity and kindness and all that. But for the most part, we know. And we know those things pay off. Even if it's something like somebody who's an evil person, a bad person, you know, even if it's just misery in the last days of their life because no one cares about them because they've been so mean and selfish, that's a consequence of its own that somebody could carry, you know, on their deathbed. Whereas I see people who are at the last stages of their lives surrounded by love because they were so good and kind and everything. And there's a lot to be said for that. The older I get, the more that seems to matter.
Absolutely. Yeah. What strikes me when I'm hearing you say all this is that it has to start with a certain amount of humility, that there's a great unknown out there that you probably don't know very much, that you don't know when you're hurting people. You don't know what the right action always is. It is very complex. You know, without being codependent and lacking boundaries, there's something to be said for just assuming an unconditional positive regard, moving forward, just trying to be good, like just navigating your little ship through these rough waters the best you can without causing more harm. And that all starts with humility.
That's a good point. And part of the humility is, as you said, It's so unfathomable. That's a word that I associated with karma in a translation of the Bhagavad Gita like 50 years ago when I first read it. And I said, okay, thank you. You just spared me. It's unfathomable. The ways of karma, the laws that govern it, and they're so complex. When we think about the complexities of our behavior and our words and our attitudes, as I alluded to earlier, it can't be known. And so we're facing uncertainty, unpredictability. If karma is real, we do know that right action will reap good results and wrong action will bring us harmful or unwanted results. But if we do it with humility and say, I'm doing my best and I'm open to learning. So if something bad happens, I reflect and I say, how can I do better in the future? That's positive result of thinking this way. Whereas if we're indifferent, if we don't care, then we don't learn the right lessons. And in Western religions, it's often like in the Book of Job, which tackles this question. Humility comes in there. In there, it's like humility before the Almighty God, who's you can't comprehend. We can't comprehend omniscience and all the qualities of God. Well, we can't comprehend the laws of the universe when it comes down to our little corner of it in our world. But we do know because we see it. If we're nice to people, they'll be nice to us. I mean, that tends to happen, especially if the same bad things keep happening to you, the same relationship breakup causes, the same business failures, whatever it is. After a while, you learn your lessons. And that's one of the reasons I think I like seeing the world in terms of karma. Because it's not a judicial system with a judge, with a gavel, sentencing you for everything you do wrong and letting you go when you do right. It's more like a school. It's like you learn lessons from the results of your karma. And if the things that happen to you, if you look at them as, okay, what is the universe giving me here to learn so I can do better in the future? Then you matriculate. You move on to the next grade and the next lesson plan and so forth. Otherwise, you're stuck and you have to repeat the same lessons over and over again. So I like that model of an educational system as opposed to a judicial one.
So I have two thoughts coming that I'll just touch on both of them. Sometimes I think the lessons people need to learn is to not be the doormat, to not get walked on.
Yes,
Like
yes.
you over self-reflect, you over take responsibility for every relationship, you do all the emotional work for everyone involved. So I just want to point
Yeah,
that out.
I talk about that in karmic relief. I learned this from a psychologist, not a guru, who said sometimes the things that our greatest strength, our biggest virtues, if we take them too far, or if we misapply them in some way, then they become our sort of enemies or our problems. Buddhists have a similar concept called the near enemy. So it's good to be compassionate. It's good to be generous. It's good to be kind. And I give some examples in the book. But if you go too far, yes, you're a doormat or you're depriving your family because you're so generous to strangers. Whatever it may be, we can misuse our virtues as well and cause karmic damage. So we have to be attentive. We have to be conscious. We have to be aware. We have to set boundaries, as we say. We have to understand our limitations. We have to understand that a certain amount of self-interest is not wrong. It's how we live up to our responsibilities in the world, especially if we have families and communities. So all these things are part of the educational plan. And part of the reason I decided it makes sense to write a book about karma. I hear
Yeah.
songs with karma in the lyrics, and I think that person needs to understand karma better.
Yeah. So the second thing that I was thinking while you were talking is a conversation I had with my dad, who's a Christian minister, just the other night. And I was like, Dad, do you even think praying helps the wars of the world, or, praying helps the suffering. And he kind of laughed. I don't know what you think of this. He said, honey, the prayer's not for them. You praying for them is for you.
Yeah.
I was like,
well, good for him, because I've heard other clergy people say that, and it's like, oh, okay. Now I remember hearing that and thinking, oh, okay, that makes sense. Because prayer is like a form of meditation. If you do it deeply, and if you do it sincerely and humbly, it's inner transformation. And those of us who are not inclined to that kind of religion say, oh, they're praying like God cares, or, God's going to listen to them. And many people do think that, and I don't want to denigrate them. But clergy people and theologians I know say, yeah, no, no, prayer's for the prayer.
Right.
And it's a spiritual practice, and it makes sense.
Yeah. It's part of what we say in yoga, svadhyaya, right? That self-reflection and reading scriptures and analyzing our actions and our thoughts and our words and our deeds.
Yeah. And speaking of yoga, some forms of prayer can legitimately be called a bhakti practice.
Right.
And it has more similar effect as, chanting or singing kirtan or whatever.
Yeah. All right. You've got so many things I want to ask you, but this one I need to know before we end today. You say that forgiveness begins at home, and that sometimes the hardest person to forgive is ourselves, and that
Yeah.
it has a slow acid drip of regret when we misbehave. Tell us about that.
I have to credit an old friend with that phrase, slow acid drip of regret. Yes, and if we have a conscience, it comes back to what we were saying before. If we have a conscience and we do something wrong and somebody is hurt by it, we'll regret it. Or if we have an opportunity to do something that would be advantageous to us and our family and we screw up, we'll regret that. And regret is a form of consequence, karmic consequence that we live in. But then it's, what do we do with it? Some people wallow in regret, and it ruins their whole life. But sometimes you go through a certain amount of regret and say, okay, what do I do now? How do I move forward? Do I change my behavior? Do I make amends? Do I express my apologies? Do I forgive myself for making that mistake? If you do those things, you're more likely to move forward constructively and behave with good karmic consequences in the future. Whereas if you wallow in regret, it's going to eat away at you, and you'll have one karmic consequence of the things we do is making ourselves sick. We don't want that. One of the things I did in karmic relief is I drew mainly upon the Hindu and Buddhist teachings about karma and right action and ethics and all that, because they take into account karma. But I also drew on the Western traditions and on psychology. And there's a tremendous amount of research on the power of forgiveness and of gratitude in our lives. Psychology has come a long way from just studying pathologies. They're studying happiness and what makes for a good life and the capacity to forgive others and ourselves is a critical one. And according to the research, sometimes it's easier to forgive other people who misbehave than it is to forgive ourselves. So it's one of the things we need to work on.
In the book, I don't want to tell the three steps of making a good amends or apology when we've behaved badly.
Yeah.
But as I read those three, which people will have to get the book to find, it again requires so much humility.
Yes, it does. Well, learning hard lessons is humbling. But if we don't have the humility, we won't learn the lesson. If we approach life's ups and downs, you get a sense that something's trying to teach me something here. But if you're arrogant, you're not going to learn the lesson. So humility matters. And it's hard. It really is hard to be humble enough to say, I did wrong and I'm sorry. And how can I make up for it? Boy, that sometimes is a very hard thing to do. And I didn't make up those steps or anything about amends. That comes also from psychology and for things like the 12-step program where making amends
I
is
thought that. I don't know which step it is that you have to make those amends, but I was like, oh, this sounds like 12-step.
Yeah. And, but then psychologists have done rigorous research on how making amends works best, because you can make amends insincerely. Oh, yeah, I guess I got to make, they're expecting me to make amends. So, you say something that you think they want to hear, but they can feel the sincerity and lack of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And certainly, what is projected out into the universe and the laws of karma include what you're really feeling inside.
And I think apologies are very much complicated by the fact that both parties probably contributed to the problem. But a true apology is saying, I'm going to take care of mine and I'm not going to comment on yours.
Yeah.
And that's so hard. Oh my gosh.
But I think, listeners, look at your own experience. When you sincerely apologize to somebody with whom you have a good relationship, you'll find if you do, very often they'll say, oh, no, it was my fault too.
Right.
They'll return what
the
you're
generosity.
Giving them. Whereas if you say it's your fault, they'll say, no, it was your fault.
Yeah.
So we mirror in that way. I've seen people make apologies where it's very hard to do. And the relief that comes when the apology is accepted, or the person says, I want to apologize for my part of it. It's a beautiful thing to see. It melts your heart. People learn and grow from those experiences.
Phil, I have one last hard question for you. You had said that we have these impressions that get what psychologists might call subconscious impressions, and what neuroscientists might say, it's kind of embedded in our nervous systems. How do we move from the bad action, the bad thought, the not so great intention that we had? How do we get more quickly to, I don't want to put this impression in my subconscious or my nervous system? Like, instead of taking a week to figure out I need to apologize or I need to change my behavior, like, how can I do that in 30 seconds? Any ideas? Because
well,
I don't like
that
prolonged suffering.
We've been focused on our behavior, our thinking process. In the book, when I turn to the practical stuff, how do we change our karma? How do we improve our karma? How do we deal with the effects of bad karma? I go from the surface of how we behave, what's right, what's wrong, what are the guidelines for good action, what should we not do, to the level of thought, because action is preceded by thought. We think and we act. So we have to work with our minds. And the yogis, the laws of karma, are very clear about that, the Buddhists as well. Right thought matters, right intention matters, because those things will determine how we act in the world, how we perceive things, how we respond. Then there's another level entirely, which is where these deep impressions are, that are on the subtle levels of the mind and the body. And everything we've done in the past leaves its mark, has an impression, either on the gross sort of nervous system or in what the yogis would call the subtle body. One of the most important things we could do is engage in practices that transform us on that deeper level, even deeper than thought and deeper than feeling. That's what yoga does. The whole repertoire of yoga, and I don't just mean asanas and the physical practices, but the breath work, the meditative practices, the devotional practices, the full repertoire, one way of understanding them is that they're disgorging from the system negative or toxic effects of the past. We call them samskaras. We call them vasanas. These are deeply embedded. Why do people feel good after they've done a set of asanas on their yoga mat? Why do people feel better and have better health outcomes when they meditate every day? Why do people recommend doing breathing when you're under stress? It's because these things change the mind and the body. And so I ultimately came down to engaging in regular practices like those that transform us, mind, body, spirit. That's part of any strategy for improving your karma, because it doesn't guarantee you'll do the right thing and make the right choice, but it certainly improves your odds. As any of your listeners know, because they're probably all yogis, you behave differently when you've done your yoga practices than you might have before you did it. You behave differently now that you've been practicing regularly for 5 years or 10 years than you would have in the past.
Right.
These are transformative practices. And one of the ways they're transformative is we're more content inside, more mindful, more perceptive, and therefore more likely to do the right thing. Now, we all know yogis who misbehave, so we can't make it, be Pollyanna about it, but it does improve things for the better.
And I love in the book how you go into great detail about the yamas and the niyamas, the deeper philosophy. It becomes so practical instead of like, oh, let's memorize these 10 laws of how to behave. It's like, oh, I'm going to use them as my process for uprooting all of that.
And one of the things I like about the yamas and niyamas, as opposed to just ordinary codes of ethics, which are important in their own right, is a lot of the yamas and niyamas are not just about doing the right thing or avoiding the right behavior. They're also spiritual practices. So they're transformative to even contemplate on their own and to try to improve at. They have, larger consequences than thou shalt not, which is sort of governing by fear.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Phil, thank you for being with us today. Is there a website you could point us to learn more about the book or your publisher? When is it coming out?
The publisher is Monkfish, and so there's a page there. But of course, Amazon and all the other online booksellers have summarized the book and have endorsements and reviews and so forth. My website, philipgoldberg.com.
What is the release date?
You can now order it.
Wonderful.
And get it from your local bookstore.
Well, thank you for coming. For anyone who doesn't know, you're kind of a famous person having written American Veda. I know you don't want to hear that, but really.
People think I'm more famous than I am. So that's a little secret.
You're famous to me.
That's the secret of writing books, is that people assume you're famous because they hear people like your book.
Okay. Well, I'm just honored that you come to share with us.
Oh, I'm honored to be with you.
And hopefully
and
we'll
your
see
yogi
you.
Listeners and viewers.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll see you next release in a few years.
Okay, it's a deal.
All right. Thanks so much, Phil. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil, for being with us today and helping us to understand karma and how to relieve ourselves from our karma. And I just want to tell a little story. I have a new friend here in Minnesota who knows nothing about yoga. She has no idea that I do yoga. She doesn't really know much about me, and it's not important. And everywhere I go in town, people say, oh, you know her, this woman. I'm not going to say her name. Let's just say it's Mary. You know Mary. Mary is the most kind and humble, generous, soft-hearted person I know. She's so amazing. I love her. And it's kind of interesting to hear it from so many people, so many times, all across town, both in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And so I was with her the other day and we were going to an art show. And I was just asking myself, like, does my nervous system feel comforted with her? Do I feel calm? Is she as soft-hearted and amazing as people are telling me? Like, I was just kind of feeling into it instead of an intellectual or cognitive analysis. I was sitting with her and feeling my body, and my body felt that. And yes, it felt calm. It felt stable. It felt good to be in her presence. And she has boundaries. She will speak truth. But there's something about her that tells me that she's going to have unconditional positive regard. And even if I screw up or do something hurtful, she's probably going to very gently and kindly let me know And then I don't have to be scared or worried that she's going to lash out and hurt me. And I want to learn from that. I want to spend more time with her. I want to understand that ability to hold the space for basically everyone she comes into contact with, and they feel it, and I felt it. So I think my friend Mary has great karma, and I think I have a lot to learn from her. So thank you, everybody, for being with us this week. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you to our guests this week, and thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour. Something that I've been working on behind the scenes with my friend Marlisa Sullivan is going to come out in 2026. We've been writing a book together for the last year where we go deeply into yoga philosophy and yoga therapy. And then we have the scientific vagus nerve, heart rate variability, all sorts of polyvagal theory to back up why it is that yoga philosophy is right on track and why it's been helping people for thousands of years. We're turning in our book this fall to the publisher, and in the spring of 2026, it should come out. So we're just giving you a little heads up that that will be coming out soon. And when it does, we can't wait to share it with you.
Thank you for listening to the Yoga Therapy Hour. We wish you a wonderful week. We hope that somehow, in a small way, we've contributed to your well-being so that you can go out and share that well-being with others. That's what life is all about, bringing in the goodness through you and then shining it out to the world. We need you more than ever. So let's all get out there, do good, be good, and have a great week.